During the lifetime of Jesus, in the Greek and Roman and Jewish eras, marriages often came to an abrupt end without any obvious provocation or justification either. I could read several quotations that I have accumulated, but lest they lead us away from the major thrust of the lesson, let me just refer to them. So much of what was written regarding the marriage status, as far as the stability of marriages were concerned in the first century and the century immediately preceding that, we get the idea that the dissolution of marriage came about by just simply a word, a sign, a message, a letter, the mandate of a freed man. This declared the separation, and the most tender of human connections, this man says, was degraded to a transient society of profit or pleasure. That was among the Romans and the Greeks. And by the second century B.C., there was no difficulty in the operation of divorce. It was purely a private matter. Either party could send the other a notice of it without any given reason or any complaint of misconduct. And then among the Jewish people also, Ben Sira, a rabbi of the Jews, gave this advice regarding divorce: if she go not as you would have her go, cut her off from your flesh. And then Josephus made this comment: he that desires to be divorced from his wife for any cause whatsoever, and he puts in parenthesis, and many such causes happen among men, end parenthesis, let him in writing give assurance that he will never use her as his wife anymore. These are some examples of the abuse to which marriage was subjected in the days of Jesus and in the century that preceded his life. And though our age in which we're living is increasingly like that age in which he lived, and we could state and spend the hour talking about the ravages of our time and the effect that they're having upon our marriages today, I think you're aware of that, and I would like to address ourselves today to a more subtle erosion, to a more subtle way of putting asunder what God has brought together. We're going to be talking today and next Sunday morning on the subject of marriage and divorce, not from a technical sense, but, for example, this morning I want to speak to you on the erosion of a marriage. Next Sunday morning, I want to study with you the rebuilding of a marriage. And all of this, perhaps because of an emphasis that we are making at this present time in connection with the Marriage Enrichment Seminar. I'm not here to sell the seminar. I'm here to sell good marriages. I'm here to help you study through this subject. I'd like to take off on a statement made by General Douglas MacArthur. General MacArthur, as he was closing his career as a soldier, made the great statement, "Old soldiers never die, they just fade away." I would like to observe with you this morning that old marriages don't die. They just erode away. The foundations of many marriages today are rapidly and yet almost imperceptibly eroding away. And we find people locked into marriage situations that are hopeless. We find them locked into marriages that have been eroding for 25 years, that have been eroding sometimes for 29 years. I talked with a woman in El Dorado last week, and she said after 29 years of marriage, "My husband just upped and walked off." And she said it just simply brought my world to an end. But that marriage wasn't ended on that day. That marriage had eroded over 29 years. I cannot believe that that marriage died that day. He just buried it that day. It had died years earlier and had been stinking for years before he buried it. Now, this dissolution of our marriage often does not come through any rebellion at the divorce decree level. At the divorce decree level, most of the time, marriages are completely beyond repair. If you wait until you go to see a counselor until the time of your divorce decree, it's been proven by statistics that about 97% of those marriages that wait that long for advice are not in store for any correction. They are there for dissolution. And that the people who come there are not coming for help. They're coming there for an out. I would like to suggest today that when Jesus said, "What God has joined together, let not man put asunder," he was speaking more than of just the visible, obvious, at the divorce decree level of dissolution. I would like to suggest that there are a number of ways in which you and I as mates, as you and I as husbands and wives, are putting asunder our marriages every day that we live. But let's look first of all, just very briefly, at the foundation of marriage. In Matthew, the 19th chapter, verses 3 through 6, we find the familiar passage that where the Pharisees came to Jesus and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" He answered, "Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female? And he said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. So they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder.'" The original design of marriage to which Jesus refers here was God's original making of that union between Adam and Eve. And in this passage here, he mentions five distinctive qualities of that original design. I mention them only in passing. But he mentions, first of all, the distinctive origin of the institution. It had to do with God. He originated it, not man. He said, "Did you not know that he who made them from the beginning made them this way?" He said, "This relationship consists of distinctive identities also. He made them male and female." To just simply be observed in passing, may it be noted that to the degree that we observe these distinctive identities of male and female, to that degree, we're building upon a strong foundation. To the degree that we try to erase the distinctions between male and female, to that degree are we in trouble. And we're in that position today in America. Thirdly, there are distinctive roles assigned. The roles of both male and female are not assigned or are not identified in this passage. The role of the man is, "Wherefore, for this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife." And the role that he's assigned is the role of the initiator. And that's all that Jesus says. That's all that he implies at this point. He doesn't go into detail. But then fourthly, we find a distinctive result being the result of this union. He says, "Therefore, they are no longer two, they are one." And then finally, he says there is a distinctive responsibility that is attendant upon this making of this union. "What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder." And I have meant to have checked this in the Greek, but I suspect strongly that this doesn't just mean men, it means people. "What God has joined together, let no one put asunder." And that may or may not be substantiated and verified by the text, but that's the meaning of the implication that Jesus has here. Women are not free to put it asunder any more than men are free. "What God has joined together, let not man put asunder." Let me read a quotation that came out of a paper presented by the Continental Congress on Marriage in the Home by a man by the name of Ogilvy. Lloyd Ogilvy, I guess, would be the way it's pronounced. This beautiful quotation, I want to share it with you. "Marriage is for oneness, loving expressed in giving. A great Christian marriage is the unrestricted giving of mind, emotion, body, will, and soul to a mate as if given to Christ. A marriage is most Christian not when it's free from problems and difficulties, but when the two persons open themselves to the Spirit of Christ, surrender their wills to Him, commit their living to Him, and as a conscious dedication seek to love each other and give themselves to each other as they have been loved and given to by Christ. This is more than making Christ the head of the home. It is the daily, hourly, moment-by-moment willingness to see Christ in our mates and to serve, love, and honor Him by what we say, do, give, and forgive. Only in this way can differences of personality be blended, the uniqueness of each one affirmed, the defensiveness of our own rights be healed, and the hurts done to us be forgiven. Oneness is that characteristic of marriage that God built into it. And you'll have to understand oneness here on as the equation of God's own purpose for marriage. One plus one plus one equals one. One plus one doesn't equal two anymore, Jesus says. But for the Christian over whose life Jesus Christ rules, and that Christian for his mate, marriage for those two people means one plus one plus one still equals one. And for the Christian, marriage is no longer just the union of two people. Marriage is for three people: the man, his wife, and our Lord, or their Lord, Jesus Christ. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. And as I said a moment ago, we often assign that external causes. We think of it as the person who rushes down to the registry or wherever you obtain the divorce file or the divorce decree, that he rushes down there and obtains this decree or files for divorce. We sometimes assign this passage that interpretation. I don't believe that's what he's saying. I believe he refers to the same thing that he referred to among the Jewish people when he talked about their hardness of heart being the responsibility, or their hardness of heart being the cause of their irresponsibility. And he assigns to us today the same cause of the breakdown of our homes in America or wherever in the world that you may live. We are ourselves responsible for our homes. You are responsible for your marriage. I am responsible for my marriage. I, as a husband, am first of all responsible. It is my position as the initiator. The wife is an equal partner in this. She also is responsible for the marriage. It takes two people, usually, to destroy a marriage. And in most marriages that are destroyed, if you'll look underneath, you'll find that both people are responsible. Both people are at fault. They are both to blame. Let me read another quote from this man, and then we'll get into the practical application. He mentions here, after asking this question about the divorce decree level, then he asks this question: what are the internal seeds of destruction in a couple's own relationship which put asunder what God has joined together? This forces us to consider the dehumanizing and debilitating attitudes, patterns, and traits with which we negate or nullify the oneness God wants to give. Bartered love, hidden agendas. Now let me identify the bartered love. There's a game that husbands and wives play where she gives him love if he gives her something else. Hidden agendas mean that I'll do this if you do thus, thus, and thus. And an agenda is laid down before approval is given. Inability to listen, where one just merely listens long enough to wait for an opening where that one can insert that one's own ideas, irrespective of what's been said by the partner. Refusal to express initiative action, which lays the blame upon husbands primarily, who refuse to initiate love. And of course, the opposite, or the companion of that would be true. The inability to reciprocate love would be the responsibility of the wife. A determined repatterning of the other's personality, manipulative behavior, judgmentalism, all of these are unproductive devices that people use to gain control in the power game of marriage. And you're familiar with all of these. I probably didn't have to define any of them, because at some time or other in our marriages, more than likely, we've used every one of these games that this man mentions here as unproductive devices in this power game of marriage. The Apostle Peter, and I want you to turn in your Bibles with me, please, to 1 Peter, the text that was read a few moments ago. I want you to notice some of these specific things, some of the specific attitudes of which you may be guilty. and of which I may be, as I stand here talking about it, find myself guilty. But listen, Simon Peter lists in these seven verses some absolute musts if you're going to have a happy, permanent, successful, and productive marriage. He talks to wives first. He says, likewise, you wives, be submissive to your husbands, so that some, though they do not obey the word, may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. And that word conversation in the King James, that is so, it is totally out of place here. This is what he's talking about. You're not won by the conversation you're talking. You're won, or you win your husband by your behavior. But that was the old word that was used to indicate behavior. But you'll understand the actual interpretation of it and the proper word here. The behavior of their wives. They may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives when they see your reverent and chaste behavior. Let not yours be the outward adorning with braiding of hair, decoration of gold, and wearing of robes, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable jewel of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. These first four verses give us six ingredients that the wife must involve or bring to a marriage. Six ingredients, if it's going to be successful. Now listen, wives, he's talking to you first. Simon Peter almost parallels the Apostle Paul, except he speaks in terms of specifics in one area. Paul speaks of it mostly in terms of specifics in another area. Peter puts more emphasis upon the wife's part. Paul put more emphasis upon the husband's part in Ephesians 5. But here, notice these six things that the Apostle Peter mentions. Number one, submission. And that means simply the surrender of oneself to the well-being of a partnership. The surrendering of oneself to the other person. That's what submission is. And I know that's an unpopular word today. We don't like to hear much about it. And in our time of equal rights, in our time of the emergence of womanhood from what has often been her slavery, she has overstepped and is being overstepped. She finds herself caught in a bind between her own freedom and the well-being of a marriage. This word submission here is mentioned twice in these few verses. She is, first of all, to be submissive to her own husband. And ladies, let me tell you this. A man knows when you're being submissive because of a genuine desire to do what's right. And he knows the opposite of that when you're being submissive and you're gritting your teeth saying, you'll get it yet. He knows the difference. He knows whether you're like the little girl that her father made her sit down in the car for her safety. And she didn't want to, but she finally sat down and was just fuming. And she said, gritting her teeth, yes, but I'm standing up inside. And your husband knows whether or not you're submissive to him, and yet you're standing up inside. He knows that. Secondly, he says you must be reverent. He'll be won by the behavior when he sees your reverent and chaste behavior. I don't believe that this is talking about only reverence to God. I believe he's talking about reverence of the husband. But this man that's referred to here isn't even a Christian. How can a wife reverence her husband who isn't even a Christian, who doesn't have what Sister Drake said about her husband, Bill, this morning? She said, he's always been a mighty good man. What if you're married to a man that's not a mighty good man? He says, you reverence him too. And if you can't reverence him, reverence the position that he occupies as a husband. Reverence the position that he occupies as the head of that house. And until you can reverence him as a husband and as a mate, reverence the position that he occupies as a husband. Reverence. And then he talks about chastity. He says you must be chaste. Submission, reverence, being chaste. And he refers here to the sexual proprieties, that which is becoming to you in your sexual demeanor. It means being discreet. It means being not provocative. It means that you have no flags out. It means that you're dropping no scent to be picked up by someone other than your husband. It means that you are to be chaste, and that the husband knows whether or not you're a chaste person by the way you live your life. Strangely enough, and yet very significantly, The fourth one of these talks about dress. And I'm confident that it comes immediately after being chaste for a specific reason. There is nothing that a woman has at her disposal by which she communicates unchasteness more aptly than she has her dress. This is the way she communicates her particular demeanor. You do it through your dress, ladies. He's talking here about gaudiness. He's talking here about the braiding of the hair and the making of the hair into such an ostentatious sign that it would cause attention to be attracted toward it. He forbids this here. One woman I saw some 15 years ago had become so interested in her hair being a certain way that she got caught in a trap, a chemical trap. And she had it fixed in a certain way, and all of a sudden it turned green on her because it just backfired. Everything went haywire. And she was seen to be a woman that was ostentatious. He forbids this here. And he forbids also the flamboyancy of dress that would attract attention to the woman's body and let the people of the world see that she was dressing for someone else other than her husband. And you know why you dress. You know why you dress the way you dress. If it's to be that seen by God and approved, it'll be one kind of dress. If it's to be seen by other men for approval, it will come out in the way you dress. Women have that at their disposal. I'd like to simply say this, that though he was referring here to gaudiness, and that to dress in a gaudy manner is to dress immodestly, and he did not have immediately under consideration the scantiness of dress, which is another way of dressing immodestly, that the message is the same either way. Whatever calls attention to your body, whatever calls attention to the physical, whatever would set you out as someone who is ostentatiously presenting herself to be viewed by other people, that, he says, is against the Christian principle. And I know that goes contrary to our grain, but it doesn't go contrary to the nature of the universe. If you look at the female bird, or the female of anything, the female bird, how is she dressed? Gaudily? No. God gave the flashy dress to the man. The Lord knew he needed it. That's right. The Lord knew that he needed to be flashily dressed. And if you look at a cardinal, man, there's nothing more beautiful than a male cardinal. And there's nothing more drab than a female. But you know what? The male cardinal really doesn't care how she's dressed because she's a she. And the man just really doesn't care. His needs can be satisfied and met whether she has on anything flashy or not. Now you trace this down through nature and you'll see that God, out of propriety and a sense of real propriety, he's given the female the lesser dress. He's given her the less ostentatious. He's given her the more plain dress. Now that's almost, I don't know whether that's without exception or not, but I suspect that it is. He's given the male bird the flashy or attractive or perhaps gaudy dress. May I say just a word here for a moment? Nature teaches women to dress modestly. Who teaches human beings to dress modestly? The parents do. Because the untaught human nature of a child, of a female, is to dress in the same way that will cause attention and attract attention to her body. And you can't really blame a teenager for that, because they don't really know all of the implications of that kind of immodest dress. But just the other night, we were sitting up from about till about 11:30 at night, talking with some of our teenagers in this congregation who had come to us for advice in view of a float trip that's going to be coming up in the next few days. And they were concerned for fear that the girls in this congregation would dress in an immodest manner that would embarrass them. And they mentioned that it was their studied opinion that there would not be more than 3 or 4 girls who would be aware of modest dress and would dress in a way that would not embarrass them. Now you say modesty is a thing that's relative. That's true.
And you'll have to decide what's right and what's modest and all. But may I just say this simple principle, that just like the birds learn from nature what is modest dress, girls learn from their mothers and fathers what's modest dress. And you need not expect a girl to know what is modest. Those of us who are parents, it's our responsibility to teach our children what is modest. And I can still hear my wife teaching my girls the principles of modesty. If it had been left up to the girls, probably they would not have dressed as modestly as their mother wants them to dress. If it's left up to your girls, they're not going to dress as modestly as they ought to dress either. And just as nature teaches her children how to dress modestly, so you and I as parents are going to have to teach our children how to dress modestly. Well, let's look for just a moment at the man. But let me conclude this section to the women by simply saying that whatever we do, whatever you as women do, contrary to these six principles, submission, reverence of your husband, chasteness, being modest in dress, and then he mentions gentleness and quietness. I forgot to mention those. Gentleness and quietness. To be gentle means to be not quick to anger. It means that you're sensitive. It means that you have a mother's touch of gentleness. And then to be quiet doesn't mean that you don't ever speak. Things get real quiet around a house when there's been an argument. It's not talking about that kind of quietness. The Lord forbid us and prevent that kind of quietness in a home. When things get real quiet, sometimes it's the calm before a storm. But what he's saying here, that a person ought to have a gentle and quiet spirit, that the woman, these six principles, submission, reverence, chasteness, modesty in dress, gentleness, and quietness, and whatever a woman does to the contrary, erodes that marriage. If she's not submissive, if she's not chaste, if she doesn't give reverence to her husband and respect, if she's not gentle, if she's not quiet, and if she doesn't dress modestly, that erodes a marriage. And all I know to say is simply this, that any such conduct that deliberately flaunts and deliberately disobeys and ignores the instructions here by Simon Peter, the Lord's own disciple, is simply due to hardness of heart. And I say that for this simple reason. People in the world are having their marriages ripped off daily. They're having themselves, their marriages are being destroyed daily because many of them don't know what the problem is. They don't know where they're missing it. We know where we're missing it. We know that these are six ingredients toward a successful marriage, which if you'll incorporate these into your marriage, we know this will work. As Christians, we've been informed. Then any willful or any disregard of these things is willful disobedience, and it must not be in the life of the Christian. Well, let's look for a moment to the husbands. He mentions here three attributes or three injunctions that he binds upon the husbands. These also are attitudes. The three that he binds are these. Number one, live considerately with your wives. Number two, live protectively with your wives, giving honor to the weaker sex. And then thirdly, he says, live jointly with your wives. You're joint heirs of the grace of life. Now, what do these three things mean? Well, to live considerately, that word is actually in the text. Live considerately with your wives. That means that you take into consideration your wife at everything that you do, everything you say. You take her into consideration. You take her well-being into consideration at all times, not just when you want to get something from her. We were watching the other day some cardinals again. We were watching them eat. And we were told by this person who has these cardinals frequent their house regularly, we were told, you ought to watch these cardinals when it's mating season. And then you ought to contrast that with the way they do when they're not mating. And this lady said that these cardinals, when they're not mating and they're feeding, that the male cardinal just squawks and kicks and scratches at the female and chases her off and won't have anything to do with her. And he just treats her terribly. But when it's mating season, she said, you ought to watch how they do. They'll get a seed, a sunflower seed, and the male will crack it open for the female, and he'll let her have that food that he's cracked open and selected. You know, there it is. Honey, you can have it. And she comes up and eats it. The old hypocrite. Yeah. That's during mating season. You know what? You'd have thought that these cardinals had been watching you and me the way we do our wives when it's our mating season. Yeah. That particular day, you know what? Oh, come here, honey. Let me crack this open for you. Let me open the door for you. Let me do this for you. Have this candy. Come on. And they act just like we act. That's not living considerately of your wife. I'll tell you something else. The time that you spend at home with your wife lets her know whether or not you really consider her as being worthy of your company. If you take every spare moment that you can be away from home, and you're away from home because of choice, when you have an opportunity to be with your wife and you let her know by the fact that you've chosen to do something else separate from her, she gets the lesson real easily. You don't really care to be with her. You're not living considerately of her. In money matters, she knows whether or not you consider her a partner. She knows whether or not you're living considerately of her. If you don't give her enough money to run the house on, she knows that. In affection, when you never touch her, and if your marriage is in that state that you're not communicating through physical touch, you're in trouble. You can't have a healthy marriage where there's no physical communication. And I mean just nothing more than just a hug or a holding of the hand or some way to communicate a genuine love and concern. Wives must have this. They must have the reassurance that they are wanted, that they are desired, that they are desirable. And for a husband to not give that to a wife is being inconsiderate of her. And you can just add several other things to it. You need to continue to court her till the day that you die. Brother Thompson, one of our loved elders, I believe he continued to court his wife until the day that he died. And we owe him that honor as the example that he gave us. Live considerately with your wives. But then secondly, he said, live protectively with your wife, giving honor to the weaker sex. What in the world does that mean? He says here, bestowing honor on the woman as the weaker sex. Is the woman the weaker sex? Well, he says so. Let me ask you a question. Is your eye a weaker member of your body? Yes, in a very real way. It can't protect itself. The hand or the fist, the finger, is much more strong than the eye. In fact, you use your eye, you use your hand to scratch your eye. You'll take off your glasses and find something in your eye and you get it out with your finger. You don't expect the eye to protect itself. You don't expect the eye to do a lot of things. You expect the eye to see. So it is with the marriage relationship. Is the wife a weaker partner in the relationship? Yes. And you know what you ought to do for her? You ought to scratch her where she itches. You ought to heal her where she hurts. You ought to shelter her where she's vulnerable. You ought to reassure her where she's anxious. You ought to help her where she's weak. This is what it means. Just as surely as you would perform that service for your eye, which in many respects is a weaker part of your body, so a husband needs to do this very kind of service to his own wife. And for a person to live with a wife and not be sensitive to her itches, her hurts, her anxieties, her needs, her vulnerabilities, for a man to live with a wife like that is to live not only inconsiderately of her, but it is to live as though a man who had no sense. It's to live as a person who is not in his right mind. The Apostle Paul said, no man ever hurts his own body, but he nourishes it and he cherishes it. And when he said no man ever abuses his own body, he meant no man in his right mind ever abuses his own body. You see, some people do abuse their bodies, but when they do, you know that he's not in his right mind. He's crazy. And any man that abuses his wife in these things that I've been referring to and maybe a host of others, you know also he's not in his right mind. He's crazy. This man makes a statement in this that I'd like to mention here. He said the masochism, and that means the sadistic abuse of human nature, is nowhere more vividly dramatized than in our distortion of the one relationship which can give greatest pleasure and satisfaction, and in our devaluation of the one person who, if loved and affirmed, can give us the greatest ego refortification. Live considerately. Live protectively. And then he says, live jointly. He says here, you're joint heirs of the gift of life. The word here, joint, in the sense of the word S-U-M or S-U-N, the word from which we get the word symphony, the prefix is this word S-U-N, which means together, together, together. Not just in proximity, but in ideals, in actuality, together. A symphony is together in proximity, but they're not in together really until they play in harmony. Many of us, perhaps in this auditorium, are together in proximity, in our houses, under the same roof. But there's no real symphony unless we're playing in the same key, to the same tune, to the same beat. And many marriages have long since lost this kind of symphony. He says you must live together jointly. Live together considerately, protectively, and jointly. And I'll tell you one thing, men. To refuse to do this is to decide definitely and with premeditation to go to hell. He says here to refuse to do this kind of service toward your wife is to let your prayers be hindered. In other words, you've severed the relationship between you and your father when you cannot live with your wife and refuse to give her due consideration. When John mentions in 1 John 4 and about verse 20, he says there, how can you love your neighbor whom you have seen? How can you love God whom you have not seen if you can't love your neighbor whom you have seen? Now that neighbor he's talking about there can be anybody. It is very much your wife. And he says here, how can you love God whom you haven't seen if you can't even love your own wife whom you have seen? So he talks to us pretty strong. Let me say this in conclusion. The seeds of erosion are passed from generation to generation. It'd be one thing if you only fouled up your own marriage. If we only contaminated our own marriage, it would be bad enough. But we foul up the generation that follows us. One of our girls received a letter from one of her friends. It came to light this past week. And in the letter, the little girl had several faces drawn with tears down them. Little old 12-year-old girl. And these faces, and it said, bad news. She said, I have some bad news. My sister is getting a divorce. She says, I have some more bad news. My mother and daddy are getting a divorce. And she had these little faces that ordinarily are round. They were round, but the frown was on them, and the tears were coming down out of the eyes. You pass on from yourself the seeds of deterioration and erosion. Someone said the greatest gift a couple can give their children is to experience Christ's love in their marriage. A child will reproduce in his own life and marriage what he has seen and felt at home. So this morning, as we consider this statement, old marriages don't die, they just erode away, I want us to give ourselves a test. Here's the test, and it's very simple. This morning in your marriage, you are either closer in your marriage relationship, closer to your mate than you were 25 years ago or than you were when you were married. You're either closer together today or else your marriage has been eroding. Now the test is simply this. I want you to ask yourself the question. Am I closer to my wife or am I closer to my husband? Are we closer together today than the day we married? If not, your marriage is in the process of erosion. How long will it be before it disintegrates? I don't know. But we need to be aware that the one who goes down to the court and files for divorce decree is not necessarily the one who has put asunder what God joined together. It may be you. It may be both of you. But what God has joined together, let us not put asunder. Think seriously on these things and may God bless us. Look at yourselves, look at your marriage. So much depends on it. Today we're going to sing an invitation song, a song of encouragement. It may be that during this invitation song you'll decide, I'm going to do something about my marriage. You may choose to go to the seminar, I don't know. But if you choose to remain as you are when you're hurting, is to willfully say, I'm going to go on eroding my marriage. I'm going to go on letting it just drift. I'm not going to do anything about it. And of course, that's disastrous. Make your decision now to preserve that one relationship that can do more for you on earth as a physical human relationship with other human beings than any institution that God created outside of the very body of His own Son. Will you do that today? And I encourage you while we stand and sing.